So before we begin the real serious discussion, Paul, I just thought you have such a fascinating background. So you could tell us a little bit about how you arrived before you wrote the book.
So I was in Iraq in 2007 during the surge that summer. And we were driving along the road and we came across an IED, a roadside bomb, as one did at the time. They were everywhere. Now, we saw it first, which is the preferred way to run into them. So I had just been in country maybe a month or so and was pretty interested to see the bomb techs come out. And I expected to see them in the big bomb suit and go up and defuse the bomb. And instead, out comes a little robot. And the light bulb went on in my head. I was like, oh, yeah, send the robot to defuse the bomb. That makes a lot of sense, right? You don't want to be up there with your face in the bomb snipping wires. And then the more I thought about it, the more I realized that there are all of these jobs in the military that are really dangerous. And that ended up dovetailing with conversations going on inside the Pentagon about where the military should be going with robotics and autonomy and autonomous weapons. But for me, initially, that was really the starting point, was that moment when I realized, wow, robots could save people's lives.
My guest today is Paul Chaudhry. He's a senior fellow and director of the Technology and National Security Program at the Center for a New American Security. You've probably seen him on CNN or MSNBC or heard him on NPR or the BBC. He's an award-winning author, and he's also served in the army in Iraq and Afghanistan. Paul, thank you for your service, and thank you for joining us on Life Meet Tech.
Yeah, it's great to meet you. Very excited to be on your show. Thanks for having me.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much. I've been cramming and reading up frantically, and you've been so prolific, and it's great.
Well, thanks. I really appreciate you thinking of me and having me join.
So your book, Army of None, Autonomous Weapons and the Future of War, was very well received. And perhaps it was the NPR interview where you talk about this young woman, perhaps a girl, who was potentially an informant. And you thought that she may be spying on the activities there. But yet as a human, you thought it was not appropriate that you use violence against her. And you set up a very interesting distinction between the way humans think and act and the ethics of war and how that might be somehow compromised if it was run through robots. Is that an accurate summary?
Yeah, it is. There was this incident in Afghanistan where I was part of an Army Ranger sniper team up on the border with Pakistan. And we were watching infiltration routes for fighters coming over the border. And we'd gone in at night, and the terrain was very difficult, and we didn't make as much progress to our hide site as we'd liked. And so when the sun came up, we were pretty exposed. And very quickly, we realized we were compromised, and we'd been seen by a local villager. Now, we expected some fighters to come and attack us. What we didn't expect is what they did next was send a little girl to scout out our position. She was maybe 5 or 6. She had a couple of goats in tow, I think ostensibly as cover, that she was herding goats. But it was pretty clear that she was there to watch us. She was not particularly very sneaky. So as she walked this long, slow circle around us, she would stare at us, and we would stare back at her and watched her. And we heard the chirping of what we later realized was probably a radio that she was carrying on her, reporting back information about our position. And she left. And not long after, some fighters did come to attack us. Now, we took care of them, and then we had to leave. And afterwards, we were discussing how we would deal with a similar situation. And we were talking about ways that we might deal with individuals in the area who might be unclear to us whether they were civilians herding goats or someone scouting for the enemy, how we might address that. Something that never came up in discussion was the idea of shooting this little girl. No one suggested that. Now, what's interesting is under the laws of war, that would have been legal because the laws of war don't set an age for combatants. Your status as a combatant under the law of war is determined by your actions. And by scouting for the enemy, She was a valid and lawful combatant, the same way as if she'd been an 18-year-old man doing that job. Now, I still think that killing this little girl would have been wrong, if not legally, then morally. And it's certainly not consistent with the values that I was raised with as an American. But when we think about introducing machines into war that are making their own decisions about life and death on the battlefield, how would a machine know the difference between what is legal and what is right? How would you program that into a machine? And what does it mean to begin handing over these life and death decisions to machines?
Now, it's fascinating. It makes me think about empathy, how even in war, there is a lot of empathy and compassion. And as humans, we are programmed to practice those values. And if we turned everything over to robots, what would the future hold?
Well, when we talk about autonomous weapons, we really mean some kind of future weapon that's making its own decisions about whom to kill on the battlefield. And it raises all sorts of complex questions. Can the machines do it reliably? Can they do it accurately? Can they do it in ways that's consistent with the law of war? But even if you meet all those criteria, even if you have this future autonomous weapon that's only killing valid enemy combatants, it's not killing civilians, it does raise difficult questions about empathy in war and ultimately humanity. I mean, war is terrible. Mm-hmm. And war involves a tremendous amount of violence. And in some ways, I think there's a risk sometimes in these conversations that people can kind of overstate the degree of humanity that sometimes exists in war today. This idea that, you know, people are always carefully weighing the life of an enemy combatant. There's a lot of dehumanization that goes on in warfare. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of lives that are thrown away for no good reason. War is a horrific tragedy, one we see unfolding in Europe and other parts of the world today. But there are these moments throughout history that we can see where people refrain from killing the enemy, even when they could, even when lawfully it's permitted, even when it might be tactically a good idea. Soldiers on patrol, and he comes across an enemy soldier bathing in a river, or sitting, you know, in a clearing in the jungle and smoking a cigarette. And, you know, the soldier refrains from firing. And we have evidence throughout soldiers' diaries of incidents like these. In the Gulf War in 91, the U.S. eventually stopped the air war before Iraqi forces were fully destroyed on the so-called Highway of Death, because U.S. commanders said it looked like we were just cruelly punishing our foes who were already defeated. So how do we preserve space for that kind of restraint, for empathy to come in? And what would it mean to use technology in a way that might foreclose that possibility?
You're quite right. But if we think about robots, certainly we have to consider these very fundamental human values and how we embed those values in these algorithms that drive the robots. Let me ask you this. What are examples of autonomous weapons that are widely used in war these days?
There's a tremendous amount of ways in which autonomy and automation is already used in weapons today. So there's a very active debate that's been underway internationally at the United Nations since 2014, where countries coming together to debate lethal autonomous weapons. But they're generally talking about future systems. And one of the debates that often comes to the fore is, well, you know, we have missiles, we have radars, we have torpedoes that have a whole lot of autonomy. They fit into a couple different categories today. One are homing munitions, so bombs, torpedoes, missiles that have a seeker on them that allow them to sense an enemy target and then maneuver to hit a moving target. The first homing munition was an acoustic homing torpedo in World War II that had microphones on the torpedo, and it could listen to the sound of ship's propellers to then steer the torpedo to strike an enemy ship. And one can understand why that would be valuable. It means that you don't have to have very precise aiming when you're aiming a torpedo at a ship. It still has to be pretty close. We now see munitions like that used in a whole variety of applications all around the world, in air, on land, at sea, and they're widely used by militaries. A whole other class of weapon system that exists today are human-supervised defensive autonomous weapons. So these are ones that are used to defend land bases or ships or ground vehicles from missile and rocket attack. If there might be situations where the speed of incoming missiles is so fast that humans can't possibly respond in time. And in those kinds of situations, humans can turn the automation to basically a full auto mode to defend that ship or that base or that ground vehicle from attack, because the speed might overwhelm human operators. And those are used by over 30 countries around the world today, and they've been around for several decades. So there are lots of ways that autonomy is already used in weapon systems, but then there are other ways in which it might be expanded in the future in more offensive contexts, in weapons that might search over wider areas for enemy targets and attack them on their own, that are going to raise much more challenging questions.
How effective are these autonomous weapons? Do we have data that says that they outperform humans by X percent?
So what are the advantages to machine intelligence over human intelligence? One of the main advantages is speed. And machines are much, much faster than humans. And particularly when quick reaction times are needed, they can be incredibly valuable. So non-military examples of this include things like automatic braking on cars or automated stock trading. There are certainly areas of warfare where that's used today in things like active protection systems for ground vehicles. So if you're in a tank and there are rocket-propelled grenades coming at that tank, there's really no time for a human to be in the loop to respond. You have to automate those defenses if they're going to be effective. We see in sort of cutting-edge machine learning applications a whole variety of areas where machines have been able to achieve superhuman performance, particularly in gaming environments, in playing games like chess and Go, or real-time computer strategy games like StarCraft or Dota 2. And what's really interesting is that the machines are not just better than humans, but they play differently than humans. They certainly have much, much faster reaction times, which can make them very effective, almost unbeatable in some types of games. But they also can find ways to coordinate their behavior among different agents more effectively. One of the things that we've seen that's really quite striking about AI performance was the Alpha Dogfight Challenge, where an AI agent achieved superhuman performance in a dogfighting simulator. Now, a whole bunch of caveats are in order. It was a simulator, not in a real-world aircraft. In terms of actual playing time, the AI actually had a lot more time in a simulator than the human did. So one of the advantages of the AI agent is because you can run computer simulations at accelerated speed,
right,
it could have vastly more experience in the simulator than a human had.
Absolutely.
The AI agent was also given perfect information in the simulated environment, so it didn't have to crane its neck to look around in the cockpit to see the enemy dogfighter. But one of the things that the AI agent did that was really striking was not only did it beat the human, and dramatically so, but it fought differently than how humans fight. So when humans are dogfighting, what they're trying to do is maneuver into a 6 o'clock position behind the enemy fighter to get in a kill shot with their guns, if they're using guns, aerial dogfighting, air combat maneuvering. Well, the AI agent didn't do that. What it learned to do entirely on its own was when the two aircraft are circling in the skies, there's a split second where they're nose to nose and there's an opportunity to get off a shot. And the AI agent learned to take that shot. It wasn't programmed to do it, but it learned that there was this tiny opportunity and it could take a quick shot with the guns and it could kill the enemy fighter. That's a shot that's effectively impossible for humans to make. It takes incredible reflexes, split-second timing. And in fact, these head-to-head gunshots are banned in training because it's quite risky because the aircraft are flying at each other head-to-head at hundreds of miles an hour. And if the pilots are distracted, they risk an air-to-air collision. Now, in combat, of course, you could do it, but it's banned in training. And it's very hard to execute in any way. But the AI agents are able to do that. And that suggests a whole space of new tactics and strategies in warfare that AI systems might be able to exploit that humans can't.
Now, it's fascinating. And like you said, you can subject these weapons to many hours of training that we can't with humans. But what happens when you have two perfect systems competing against one another? Which system would eventually prevail?
Well, certainly, we don't know. It might depend on the details of each system. I think we have seen some areas of competition in the real world where machine-to-machine competition can introduce this whole new domain. And stock trading is a great example of this, where stock trades can be executed at superhuman speeds. And that's led to now this whole new domain of trading in milliseconds, where you have machines reacting to how other machines and algorithms are executing trades. And it's this whole space that humans can't play in this new era of competition at superhuman speeds. And I think it's entirely possible that we could see something similar happen in warfare, where there are these domains of competition where we've effectively turned over the keys to the machines.
And so we have talked a lot about machines and potentially how they have agency these days. But this is not a new phenomenon, right? I mean, automation, it goes back many years. And you're a student of history as well. Give us an example from years past where we have really used automation as an advantage in war.
Really, the origin of automation in warfare started in the Civil War with the Gatling gun, with the use of industrial era technology to then speed up the process of firing and dramatically exploded lethality in the battlefield, but about 100-fold, increasing the amount of firepower that soldiers could bring against the enemy advancing on them. Now, what's really interesting and tragic about this story is that the inventor of the Gatling gun, Mr. Gatling, was motivated by looking at suffering of soldiers coming back from the Civil War, and he wanted to reduce the number of soldiers on the battlefield. So he thought, well, if I could build a machine that could take some of the inventiveness and industriousness that we see in agriculture and factories and other aspects of the Industrial Revolution, and I could automate aspects of warfare, then we can have fewer soldiers on the battlefield and we could save lives and fewer soldiers would be killed and come back maimed and injured. Reality was, unfortunately, the opposite of what he intended. What happened was it dramatically expanded the lethality on the battlefield to where when he got to World War II, we saw things like the Battle of the Somme, where 10,000 British soldiers were killed in a day, and the amount of firepower unleashed on the battlefield through automation, through machine guns, not only led to a tremendous amount of bloodshed, an entire generation of European young men killed in that conflict, but also really changed tactics in a way that military leaders at the time just didn't understand and weren't prepared for. And they didn't know how to adapt to that. It took quite some time for them to figure out how to even respond to this new level of lethality.
Going back to the Gatling gun and to modern weapon systems, the effectiveness cannot be determined until you really use it in war. Is that correct?
Well, certainly one of the unique things about war as a human activity, and a good thing, is that it's very rare. And so militaries are training, they're developing new technology, they're developing new tactics in peacetime, but they don't really know how it's going to work until they fight a war. And then they find out whether their training was any good or their tactics were any good. And we certainly see, for example, in the Russian military's performance in Ukraine today, what can happen when a country's leaders are surprised by the ineffectiveness of their military. As the Russian military has performed quite poorly, I think it's safe to say, relative to both the expectations of Russian leaders, but also of U.S. defense analysts in terms of what they would have expected out of the Russian military. So when new technologies are introduced, that can add all sorts of complications because no one really knows what's going to happen with this technology. And opponents of autonomous weapons often paint a picture of these rogue machines running amok, murdering civilians. That could be possible. Certainly one of the things that autonomous weapons do is they compress the amount of lethality into the machine, much like the Gatling gun. Instead of the human having to take all sorts of manual actions to then deliver firepower on the battlefield, the human might simply push a button to launch an autonomous weapon that then carries out all of these attacks. That means that we could could lead to more violence in war. It could see less restraint in war, as humans are less psychologically engaged with killing, and they maybe feel less responsible over time. And when there are accidents, certainly the scale of accidents could be much greater in terms of civilian casualties and other effects. However, those who are opposed to, say, a ban on autonomous weapons, who want to preserve the ability for countries to build these weapons, will often argue, well, perhaps they could be more precise and more humane. People aren't perfect. People make mistakes. People commit war crimes. And maybe machines could do better. Maybe just like someday self-driving cars should be able to reduce fatalities on the road, machines might be able to do something similar in warfare by avoiding civilians and only attacking enemy combatants. And that also has valid precedent. One of the things that we've seen over the last 70 years is the development of precision-guided weapons that has shifted aerial bombing from the sort of area bombing in World War II that leveled whole cities in Europe and Asia to now very precise strikes against individuals, against vehicles. And so it's also possible that autonomous weapons might make warfare more precise and humane. A lot of it really depends on how we use the technology. The technology could do either one. It's a question of what use we put it to.
This kind of surgical precision that we get these days with the bombing raids, and as countries become more proficient at it, is there a potential danger of a flash war?
It's one concern that I have when I think about what a world with autonomous weapons might look like. So we've seen in stock trading that one of the effects of having algorithms responding to other algorithms has been these flash crashes where the stock price moves very, very rapidly because of the way machines are interacting. Could something happen similarly in warfare? It's certainly possible that machines interacting with each other in unpredictable ways could lead to these unexpected interactions. So if you took a period of tense militarized dispute between countries, like imagine the Cuban Missile Crisis, and now you introduce autonomous weapons, it's hard to see how that makes things better. That handing over some of these decisions to machines complicates political decision-making, complicates leaders' ability to maintain control of their forces in many ways. And the real challenging thing in international relations is there's no referee to call time out if things get out of control. It's not like, you know, in stock trading where there is a regulator who can say, okay, they can impose some rules on behavior. If states are going to agree to find ways to avoid something like a flash war, they're going to have to find ways to work with their adversaries. And that's obviously very challenging to do, but I do think that the imperative is very high to look for opportunities to do so.
What sort of advantage does the United States have on these cyber attacks or autonomous weapons compared to other countries? I know back in the 60s when we sent a man to the moon, America had a distinct advantage in science and technology. Where do we stand today, and who are the other nations that have, you know, gained ground?
So the U.S. military has been for decades the most technologically advanced military on the planet. However, that technological advantage is waning today. So in 1960, the United States as a nation controlled almost 70% of global research and development. And the Defense Department alone controlled 36% of global R&D. So the U.S. Defense Department was a huge dominant player driving the future landscape of science technology. Now today, through a combination of globalization and privatization, their share of global R&D has gone from 36% down to 3.6%. So in a very different technology landscape, one where the U.S. military has to react to a world that is technologically very flat. It's very globalized. And other countries have access to the same kinds of technological innovation, either because it's occurring elsewhere around the world. It's not occurring in the United States. And certainly China is a major technology leader. They're a major global competitor to the U.S. in technology. And they have dominant companies in artificial intelligence, wireless communications, genomics, and other areas. Or in some cases, it might be U.S. companies that are ahead, but it's not coming out of secret defense labs. So technology like AI is, in some ways, it's the opposite of stealth technology. that was invented in secret defense labs, and the U.S. military has actually been able to maintain a lead in stealth technology for decades, which is incredible. Instead, you can go online and download trained neural networks for free on places like GitHub. The technology is everywhere, and it's the AI community in particular is very, very open. And so the U.S. really can't count on a technology advantage in AI and autonomy. If it's going to have a battlefield advantage, it's going to have to be in how the U.S. uses the technology. The real important dynamic is not going to be who gets the technology first or has the best technology, but who finds the best way of using it. That's what's going to determine who's ahead.
But what if soldier robots are introduced in battle? Is that a possibility? How far away are we from that? And do the Russians really have such capability?
Well, we certainly see drones used widely in conflicts around the world. The U.S. has been using them for the last 20 plus years. Other countries are using them. We're seeing them being used not just by states like Russia and Ukraine, but also non-state groups. ISIS had a fairly significant drone capability that they were using to attack Iraqi and U.S. forces. Land robots are further behind because it's more difficult to navigate on land. And there's a lot more clutter in the way. The sky is just more open space, so it's easier for a drone to maneuver around. But the technology is certainly coming. But I do think we will see more ground robots over time. I think we're going to continue to see more robotic systems incorporating more autonomy being used around the world in conflicts. And, you know, it's sort of taking us slowly down this path towards this fundamental question of, well, what happens when machines are able to then fully execute attacks on their own? What happens when a predator drone has as much autonomy as a self-driving car and able to make its own life and death decisions?
So what do you think is the future? What is the take-home message for us?
Technology is going to give us the power to build machines that can make life and death decisions on the battlefield. And that raises very difficult legal and ethical and policy questions. And how we use this technology is up to us. Now, there are some who will say, look, others are going to build autonomous weapons, so we need to build them first and get ahead. The reality is that when you look historically, there have been situations where militaries have been able to successfully engage in restraint in warfare, holding back on the development of chemical weapons, or limiting some competition in nuclear weapons to help maintain a more stable balance, to avoid some hair trigger advantage to striking first with nuclear weapons. It's really important that countries think hard about ways to manage some of the most dangerous outcomes with autonomous weapons, things like a flash war, and ensure that autonomous weapons are used in a way that complies with the law of war, and that ultimately keeps humans in charge of decisions on the battlefield.
Yeah, this is an important topic, obviously, and one that really touches the core of all of humanity. So, Paul, what can you say about the B-21 stealth bomber? I hear it has a drone component.
So the B-21 stealth bomber is a new bomber that the Air Force is building as a replacement for the B-2 stealth bomber, which is quite old. And one of the main reasons why the Air Force needs this aircraft is that China has been developing a whole suite of capabilities that are largely viewed under the frame of anti-access capabilities to keep the United States out of the Western Pacific. Long-range missiles, ballistic missiles, cruise missiles that could target U.S. bases. And most U.S. aircraft are short-range fighter aircraft. And the problem is that in a conflict, they're not going to have the legs to get close to an adversary. And so the U.S. needs longer range aircraft, and they need large bombers because the reality is that major warfare entails quite a bit of ordnance. And so the B-21 will be a major upgrade for U.S. air power. The long-term plan is to have a drone version of it, although the original version will have a human still in the cockpit. And the B-21 will also have the nuclear mission. The Air Force has made very clear that there will always be a human in a cockpit if there are nuclear weapons on board. They want to maintain very strict control over nuclear weapons. But it's a really important component of maintaining U.S. military superiority into the future.
And what is the price tag for this?
So it's $550 million in 2010 dollars. So, okay. You start adding in inflation and it's
going to go up. Oh, my goodness, yes. Certainly. Well, Paul, thank you so much for joining us on Life Meet Tech. Thank you for sharing your insights. It's been a very interesting conversation.
It's been great talking with you. Thanks for including me.
Life Meet Tech is presented by WKAR in association with Michigan State University. Executive producer, Melanie Paul. Audio engineer, Drew Hill. And hosted by me, Prabhu David. Please subscribe wherever you're listening right now so you don't miss an episode. And I'll see you next time on Life Meet Tech.